Good afternoon, everyone. Continuing a little bit the theme Corey developed there about fighting, although we're just touching bases and use some information regarding D-Day and other things as just a part of the sermon, but actually hope to turn it around and be able to look a little bit about families. Not that families should be a places where a lot of fighting takes place, but there are lessons that we can learn through the struggles and stuff of this world, and that the family really is in many ways a foundry of the future, because in that family are produced the next generation and so on and so on. Anyway, back to, as Corey mentioned, June the 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the landing on the beaches of Normandy, an incredible event, and we'll touch upon some of those things that took place that day. But as a point of introduction to that, General Dwight David Eisenhower, who became president after his military career, served two terms as president of the United States. He was the general of the army. He was the commander of the Allied forces, and he was in charge of D-Day. The order of the day, the communication that was given out to the soldiers who would embark upon that great undertaking, read, at least in part, as follows. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven for many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened, and he will fight savagely. General Eisenhower continued, I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. He went on to say, we will accept nothing less than full victory. He concluded, let us all beseech the blessings of the Almighty upon this great and noble undertaking. We'll modify that a little bit as we get to the end of the sermon today, because I think it can apply to the undertaking that we have as families, whether you're a young family, your children partway grown, or where we are older and maybe able, when asked, to pass on information and help to other people. But let's look a little bit closer at some of the things that took place on D-Day. Many of you will recall the elder who was a part of this church for many years, Mr. Jerry Smith, was a part of the D-Day invasion. He piloted some of the boats that brought the men in. One particular place was a battle that President Ronald Reagan paid a lot of attention to when he gave a speech on the 40th anniversary of D-Day. He was there on site at a place, forgive my pronunciation of it, but Point Duhok, and it was a sheer cliff, 100 feet up. The Germans were entrenched on the top of that with rifles and big guns. They were entrenched. There were 225 Army Rangers that were assigned to take that. It was the 2nd Ranger Battalion, 100 feet straight up, and that was their task, was to take that. The Germans were entrenched above. They were shooting down and dropping grenades on the men as they were climbing this rope. President Reagan brought out quite a bit of this in his speech. When one man was hit, another took his place. When the Germans cut one rope, the advancing Ranger would grab another, always, always advancing, using ropes, grappling hooks, and ladders, holding on and firing back, always, always advancing. The guns above, they knew those guns, because those guns were trained upon the beach where the landing craft was coming in. Those guns had to be taken out. The guns above must be silenced, for they rained death down upon the Ranger brothers on the beach. When the fighting subsided, only 90 of the 225 Rangers who were assigned to take the cliffs were still alive and able to bear arms. Only 90 of those were left able to bear arms at that point. As President Reagan gave that speech that day, if you ever had the chance to Google it, you would probably be well served to do it. You can hear the whole thing and see it. Sitting before him when he gave that speech 35 years ago, these men were in their 60s now. There were 62 of the Rangers there listening to that speech that day that Reagan gave on the 40th anniversary. He looked out upon them and he said, these are the boys of Point Duhok. These are the men who took those cliffs. They were sitting before him. Who were these men? Who were these men? They were just men from the farms and the boroughs and the towns of America. Just two examples that I dug up. One was William Elrod Petty. He was 63 years old when Reagan gave his speech, which was on the 40th anniversary. So he was a 22, 23-year-old young man when he gave the speech. You know, just as a point of comparison, to see how wimpified we're getting. You know, you can be 26 years old and still be on mom and daddy's insurance policy. We have a whole different way of looking at things. It's no wonder, at least in part, why we're in such bad shape. But anyway, William Elrod Petty, long before this, he lost his teeth playing football. He suffered two broken legs in military training before he joined the unit of the Army called the Rangers. It took him three tries to reach the top because of the shooting and the ropes being cut. It took him three tries to reach the top, but he did reach the top, and he took out 30 Germans when he got there. Another gentleman, Leonard G. Bud Lommel, age 64 at the time of Mr. Reagan's speech, just an ordinary fellow, too. He was a railroad brakeman before the war. He was shot in the side. He barely made it up to the top, but he did, and he took out two of the German big guns when he got there. How'd they do that? How did those men do that? Simply put, it was their duty. It was their duty to do it. It was their duty to press forward and realize, I looked this up and checked it out as best as I could anyway, of the men that served in World War II, 10 million of those were draftees. Now, that's something we don't hear of anymore. They were conscripted into the military. When you were a draftee, which I received one, you'll get a notice. I can't remember. I should have saved it. But from the President of the United States hereby orders you to report to. I had to report to the post office in Modesto. Got in a Greyhound bus, went to a processing center in Fresno. Basically checked me. I guess my heart still pumped. And so in the Army, I went and got shipped over to Fort Ord. From the time after I got there, I remember it just comes to my mind now, you're on the bus there, and this guy comes on, sergeant, whoever processed at the time, and they're talking, and you're thinking to yourself, young and stupid, you know, and you're sitting there on the bus and blah, 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 blah. And okay, this might not be so bad after all. Then he finishes the night part, and he says, you, blankety blank, got 30 seconds to clear this bus. And it went downhill from there. But anyway, at that point, once you took that oath, you were not your own person. You belonged to the United States Army or whatever branch of the service you were in. You were conscripted in, and you took orders. Well, we realize, brethren, that we are not our own. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians. There's connections, I think, that we can make, as Corey was bringing out. We can study these things, and we can see principles that carry over, that we can learn, that we can carry into our Christian life and learn from. 1 Corinthians, let's go to chapter 6. Just as a conscript, one who is drafted into the military, he is not his own person anymore. He belongs to the government. You will be shipped where they tell you to be shipped. You will go to bed when they tell you to go to bed. You will get up when they tell you to get up. And you will march in a line and eat what they put before you. You are not your own. In a way, you know, kind of bad that it's probably not around to some degree now, because I think it would benefit a lot of people. But anyway, 1 Corinthians 6:19. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? You are not your own, for you were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So we are not our own. We have duties. We have responsibilities. So again, back to my question, how did these men do that? How did they do that? Well, they were men with a mission. The 225 Rangers, their mission was to take Point du Hoc. But there were thousands of those men up and down the beaches. Each group had their mission. They were a unit that was given an objective. That stronghold, no matter what the resistance, they had a mission to take that. That's a word, I was thinking about that a little bit. Maybe it's just to my ears, but that word almost sounds odd to our ears nowadays, I think. The word mission, from the standpoint of having a mission, an assignment, something to be done, something that's expected of you to accomplish, we've gotten away from that idea. It's more, well, if that works out for me, I'll do it. These men had a mission. They had a mission. They had to take that stronghold no matter what. shooting rope ladders over a 100-foot cliff, climbing those ladders with people shooting down upon you. How did they do it? We've often heard, recently we've heard it, I've used it before too, we've often heard of the term all in. We use that reference about the church and our commitment to the ways of God. We use that term all in. How about this for being all in? Did you know that every man who came ashore on D-Day, June the 6th, 1944, carried in his pack a burial bag, which if he was to be killed, the grave processing teams, platoons and stuff, their job was to process the dead. They know that would happen. But each man carried a burial bag that he rolled or folded up and placed into his pack. The message was clear. Some of you would die. Some would die. That's being all in. When you pack your own burial bag in your pack and you take the shores. So that's what these men did. Well, no matter the cost, the free world, as Eisenhower brought out in his words there, no matter the cost, the free world must gain a stronghold in what the Germans considered Fortress Europe. The Germans were entrenched. Well, brethren, we too, as people that God has called the Pentecost people, as we'll term those that God has called just that simple group of first fruits, we have a mission too. The world is a fortress, as Corey was bringing out. There's many things that are stacked contrary to the ways of God, and those things have to be overcome. Many of those men died taking Point du Hoc and the other objectives that they had that day. Many died, but take it, they did. And to use a term that Abraham Lincoln used in his speech at Gettysburg, the dedication of that battlefield, Lincoln said in that speech, they gave the last full measure of devotion, as did these men on D-Day do the same thing. Is anything less, do you think, expected of us from God, but to give anything less than that last full measure of devotion? And yet, oftentimes we, because of the culture in which we're raised and the tendency of people to want to have a cushioned life, that we don't find that to be very appealing. But again, we'll go back to a question I asked earlier. Where did such men come from? Where did they come from? More important, I think we could ask, because the past is the past, where did such men come from? I think more importantly, we could ask now, where do such men come from? And I can use the same term, ladies, as well, because each have their place in life. We want men or women to be people of high character. Well, where do such men come from? We'll just stay with the male pronoun at this point, just for the sake of simplicity. Where do they come from? Well, they come from homes, and they come from families. Families, brethren, as I mentioned earlier, families are the foundry of the future, for that is where the next generation is produced. The foundry where, to a large degree, the character, the metal of the next generation is cast in that family. The dynamics within that family, the maturity of the mother, the maturity of the father, the seriousness of which they approach their task. And here in a family, the tempering process of that child begins. I'm no expert on it, but I took a few metal shops in high school. Have you ever heard of tempering metal? Tempering metal. Remember in high school, we could make like a cold chisel, something you could hammer with a hammer and cut another piece of metal. Well, that steel you would heat up in the forge or the furnace there, and you would beat it into the shape you wanted, but the tempering of it has to do with the cooling process. You cool it at a certain pace. You either dip it in water or let it cool at a certain pace, and that's called tempering. And by the manner in which you temper it, it depends on what you're trying to make, it strengthens that metal. That metal is made stronger by means of how it's heated and by means of how that metal is cooled. And so are people. We can be tempered by our experiences in the families. Tempering metal improves the characteristics of the metal. You can take that steel chisel and temper it correctly, hone an edge on it, and use that steel to cut other steel. Why? Because of the way it was tempered, the way that it was heated and the way it was cooled. Heat it to a high temp, but below the melting point. We're not trying to melt the metal. We're trying to heat it so it becomes malleable, so we can put it in the form we want it, and then you control the cooling, and therefore you temper that metal. A home is that way. It's a foundry. And that foundry, which we call, for the sake of the message today, that foundry is the family. And that foundry is underneath the authority of two individuals, each joint heirs before God. And that is the father and that is the mother. They are joint heirs, each are equal before God as far as that which they can inherit in the family of God. However, there is authority within the home, obviously, for the sake of order and decency. There is a certain order within that family. But it is the foundry. It is the foundry of the next generation, is that home. We are joint heirs before God. However, we each have distinct responsibilities, but with a joint mission, just as on D-Day. They had a joint mission. Their mission was to claw back Europe. But each one had their particular distinct responsibility, but they all had a mission. Mr. Jerry Smith, his responsibility was to pilot that Higgins landing craft up in there. Other men had other responsibilities, but the mission was the same, take Europe. They did take Europe, brethren, and you know how? 1 foot at a time, 1 foot at a time. And then those feet turned into yards, and then that cliff was taken, and the big guns were taken out, and they advanced and advanced and advanced. But it was all just a foot at a time. Army, Navy, Air, the responsibility to the mission was take Europe. But first they had to take the beach. And we want to create those young people in that foundry that we call home that will serve God in the world tomorrow. We go back to my question I asked earlier. How'd they do it? How'd those guys do it? How'd they ever face that? I'm sure in those Higgins landing crafts, I'm sure there was a lot of vomit in the bottom of those crafts when they come up there. Those guys were scared, just like you or I would be scared. But they did it. Well, young men, brethren, are not pampered into manhood. They don't reach manhood in the shadow of mom. They do not reach manhood because dad has smoothed the path and removed the obstacles. That's not how they reach manhood. Indeed, it is the obstacles that are overcome that leads to manhood. Remove the obstacles, keep him or her within your shadow, and thwart their development. It's that simple. Remove the obstacles, you don't do your child a favor in the slightest. Now, I'm not saying we try to make life rough for people. It's not Johnny Cash. Remember the song, A Boy Named Sue? He said his daddy knew life was going to be tough, so he named him Sue because he knew he'd have to fight every day of his life with a name like that. So we're not talking about making people's life miserable. We're talking about being mature and wise in the rearing of our children. Because boys can't live in the shadow of mom. Boys outgrow the shadow of mom. They just do. But the influence of her character will be forever upon them, for the good or for the bad, as the case may be. Genesis 2:22, let's go back there, look at this foundry, the beginning of it, because it is God ordained, absolutely God ordained. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 22, back at the time of creation, Genesis 2:22. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Therefore, this is God speaking. The latter part of verse 23 was Adam saying, "This is bone of my bones." This is now God. "Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." They shall form a unit. They shall form a unit, a separate entity, as it were, as husband and wife, but it is now a family bearing that single name. Our tradition in the West bearing the last name of the man, the father. But it is God ordained, and they are to form this family and become one flesh. Well, from this union, it is God's desire, as we will see clearly, from this union of man and woman would come self-starters. We're going to go to Malachi in a few minutes because God seeks godly seed. It tells us that very clearly. Well, this union, this foundry that is headed up by the father and with his wife right at his side, this foundry is to produce young men and young women who are self-starters. They are able to operate independently. They are individuals that will set a high bar for themselves. They are not interested in setting the lowest possible bar for themselves. They are interested in setting a high bar for themselves. They are unfazed by the prospect of failure. Failure is a part of life. It's a part of life. So we want to raise them where they're unfazed by the prospect of failure. Individuals who, if they do fall, they get back up. Remember, the righteous falls 7 times, but he still gets back up. So that's what this foundry is supposed to be doing. But within that foundry, of course, for it to have its greatest possibility of success, there has to be unity, obviously, within that foundry. You cannot have them working in directions contrary, cross purposes within the management, if we use that terminology here, within that foundry. Malachi, I mentioned Malachi. Let's go to Malachi chapter 2. Malachi 2. Malachi chapter 2. Last book of the Old Testament. And let's go to the beginning of verse 14. Yet you say, for what reason? I'm breaking into the middle of something here, brethren, but it'll clarify, I believe. And yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. Yet she is your companion and your wife of covenant. We all understand Mr. LeBlanc has covered many times the importance, the aspect of a covenant. A covenant is dead serious. And your wife by covenant. But did he not make them one, having, verse 15, a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? Remember, we're getting back now to Genesis 2, where we were, where it says, these two shall become one. And we're asking the question here in Malachi, but did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? Why did he make them one? He seeks godly offspring. He seeks godly offspring. That foundry is supposed to produce godly offspring. You are charged with that. I am charged with that. The same as the rangers were charged with taking Point Du Hoc. That responsibility is upon you. That responsibility is upon myself. That responsibility is upon that foundry to produce material that God can eventually, in his way, train it down the course that he wants it to go. Therefore, take heed to your spirit and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. The point is, God seeks godly seed. He seeks godly seed. So this foundry, this production facility, we call it that, this foundry where we produce these young men and young women that consist of a man and a woman, a husband and a wife. They are made different. We all know that quite a bit, you know, quite well, not just physical components, but we think differently. And therein is sometimes the frustration, but therein is the beauty. Therein is the beauty. The more a man tries to make his wife like him, the less attractive she will be to him. God made it very distinct difference between men and women. And it's a beautiful thing. Again, I'll use this for the second time in 2 sentences. Frustrating sometimes, but a very, very beautiful thing. God knows exactly what he's doing. They are made different, and that difference is to be respected on both sides. That difference is to be respected, and that difference is to be appreciated. It's to be coming together and creating that foundry. As we respect and honor that difference, we respect and honor our Creator. Because he has made it thus. When we respect and honor that difference, we respect and honor our Creator. From years ago, a good analogy that a man who used to write a lot of Christian marriage books, Gary Smalley was his name, Gary Smalley. But he used the analogy of a butterfly and a buffalo. I don't know if any of you ever heard that analogy. It makes it very clear because men and women are different. We handle things differently. Men, for the most part, or with the broader shoulders, and in general, we're more strength, more muscular, have the endurance to handle things. And that's the way it should be. Women nurture, bring up the children, and one is no better than the other. We're just different. Well, Mr. Smalley brought up the analogy of the butterfly and the buffalo. Now, the butterfly has a very keen sensitivity. Even to the slightest breeze, a butterfly will feel that breeze. That can be moved to the side by a breeze. Very easily. And the butterfly also can hover around and appreciate as he lands upon the smallest flower. A buffalo doesn't react to a breeze in the slightest. Buffalo isn't even going to react to a 30-mile-an-hour wind. They're made different, right? If you take a small stone, just a tiny pebble, if you somehow attach it, tape it to the wing of a butterfly, you've crippled that butterfly. If you take that same stone and put it on a buffalo, the buffalo doesn't know you put anything to it. And that's what men can do to their wives. Yeah? They can do that unknowingly. Well, you should be able to handle that. She's made different. And maybe she can. Maybe she can handle more than she thinks she does. But my point is, we're made different. That which is inconsequential to the man is very consequential to the woman. We have to respect and honor those things. And we have to be very serious about that, brethren, and take it serious. I mean, enjoy life. Don't ever forget to smile and laugh, you know, within your own home. But you can see it happening in a culture overall. And when you have a great number of women in any culture, in any society, that develop, as it were, four heads of iron, and a great number of men who have allowed themselves to become effeminate, the devil has done his work. The devil has done his work. When you have that, women, four heads of iron, men who have allowed themselves, because you do give permission for it to happen, men who have allowed themselves to become effeminate in one manner or another, the next generation will slide yet further into the moral abyss, that canyon, as one guy terms it, radical individualism, where it's not about what's good for the whole, it's what satiates me, what makes me pulsate, that radical individualism. If that rules in you, if that rules in anybody, you've got a problem coming. It's not about you, and nor is it about me. It's about the duty. It's about taking the cliff. It's about taking the beach. But if we allow those things to happen to us, the next generation will slip further, and in the course of time, as it mentions in Genesis, I think it is, the iniquity of the Amorites will be full, and the land will vomit out its inhabitants because it can't bear up underneath that. We need not search far and wide, brethren, to understand what the guidelines in our relationships are. We don't have to search for that. We have to appreciate the fact that there is a great difference between us. This is somewhat comical, but I think it really illustrates a good point. Dave Barry, remember, he used to write columns in the newspaper. The title of this little article he wrote is, "What's He Really Thinking?" Contrary to what many women believe, it's fairly easy to develop a long-term, intimate, and mutually fulfilling relationship with a guy. And we're just exploring this difference between men and women here for a few moments. Of course, this guy has to be a Labrador Retriever, or it isn't going to happen. With human guys, it's extremely difficult. This is because guys don't really grasp what women mean by the term relationship. Let's say a guy named Roger is attracted to a woman named Elaine. He asks her out for a movie, she accepts, and they have a pretty good time. A few nights later, he asks her out for dinner, and again, they enjoy themselves. They continue to see each other regularly, and after a while, neither one of them has seen anybody else. And then, one evening, when they're driving home, a thought occurs to Elaine, and without really thinking, she says it out loud, "Do you realize that tonight we've been seeing each other for exactly 6 months?" And then there was a silence in the car. To Elaine, it seems like a very loud silence. She thinks to herself, "I wonder if it bothers him that I said that. Maybe he's been feeling confined by our relationship. Maybe he thinks I'm trying to push him into some kind of obligation, and he doesn't want it, and he isn't sure of." And Roger is thinking, 6 months? And Elaine is thinking, "But hey, I'm not sure I want this kind of relationship either. Sometimes I wish I had a little more space so I'd have time to think about whether I want us to keep going the way we're going." So all these are playing out in Elaine's mind. I mean, where are we going? Are we just to keep seeing each other at this level of intimacy? Are we heading towards marriage, towards children, towards a lifetime together? Am I ready for the next level of commitment? Do I really even know this person? And Roger is thinking, so that means, let's see, 6 months ago, let's see, that would be February when we started going out, which was right after I had the car at the dealer's. This means, let me check the odometer. I'm way overdue for an oil change. So it goes on, and Elaine is thinking, He's upset. I can see it in his face. Maybe I'm reading this completely wrong. Maybe he wants more from our relationship, more intimacy, more commitment. Maybe he has sensed, even before I sensed it, that I was feeling some reservations. Yes, I'll bet that's it. That's why he's so reluctant to say anything of his own about his own feelings. He's afraid of being rejected. And Roger is thinking, and I'm going to have them look at that transmission again. I don't care what these morons say. It's not shifting right, and they better not try to blame it on the weather either. What cold weather? It's 87 degrees outside, and this thing is shifting like a garbage truck. And I paid those incompetent thieving guys $600. And Elaine is thinking, he's angry. And I don't blame him. I'd be angry, too. I feel so guilty. And it just goes on and on. It's priceless, but for time's sake, I have to set it aside. But we're different. We're different. Women are much more relationship-oriented, but these things have to meld together to give that foundry the best possible chance of producing that tempered steel that we want, be it man or woman. Well, we don't have to search really far, brethren, to get our basic guidelines anyway. Again, this isn't some deep sermon by any means. I'd be incapable of it on marriage, but just a brief view, refresher. Let's go to 1 Peter. God gives us the information that we need, 1 Peter 3, but you have to be filled with a sense of mission. If you don't have that, it just becomes intellectual. It just becomes something we read and think about a little bit. But if you don't have a sense of mission, if you don't look at your children and say, God holds me responsible for what I do with those little guys or girls, as the case may be. Because he does. He does. You have to have a sense of mission. If you don't have a sense of mission, you will flounder. You will inevitably flounder. 1 Peter 3, there's several, four or five main scriptures you could turn to in the New Testament for guidance, outline, let's put it that way, about the marriage relationship. But we don't need to delve into that. They're all actually quite similar. 1 Peter 3, 7, an admonition to the men, where Peter says in his letter, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding. In other words, we are not to be buffaloes. We may be strong and have more endurance and all that, but we are not to, as the butterfly is taking in the beauty of the flowers, the buffalo shouldn't be trampling over those same flowers and trampling them into the mud. There's a difference. We have to understand that. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being, as I mentioned earlier, as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Our prayers can be hindered. If you wanted to look at that word hindered, it means frustrated, cut down, cut off, hewn down by the operation that takes place within that home, within that family. So men, we have to dwell with our wives with knowledge, understanding, and giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. Skip across the page, at least in my Bible anyway, still in 1 Peter 3, but we'll pick it up in verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husband. That word submissive and submit, it just simply means to line up in an orderly fashion beside. To line up in an orderly fashion beside somebody. The husband, I used the analogy before, in the military, when you were forming a line in a squad or a platoon, and you were called into order, you called to attention, you click your heels, you line up, and the drill sergeant would be, dress right. That means you look to your right, and your shoulder is lined up directly with the man on your right. That's what this is talking about, line up in an orderly fashion. That's what it means. Likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they will without the word, they may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Do not let your beauty be that of the outward adorning or the arranging of the hair. It doesn't mean neglect it. It doesn't mean neglect the care and refinement of yourself. It means let that not dominate what you think, because what God finds precious is what is on the inside. Do not let your beauty be that outward adorning of arranging the hair, of wearing gold, or of putting on fine apparel, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. So you see in those few 3 or 4 verses right there, and the one we read about men, how it really capsulizes and begins to catch the main thought that if we just hold on to those main thoughts, it helps so much, brethren, in that relationship. She, a wife, can offer great, great insight. There are going to be interpersonal relationships and stuff like that. Again, there's exceptions to everything. But for the most part, I think, generally speaking, she's going to be more insightful of those things than what the man will tend to be. Because we will tend, in those personal relationships, again, to be the buffalo trampling over the daisies. The men, by and large, they see a point, and that's where they're going. They've got a mission, they want to accomplish that mission. She's more in tune with what's going on, the vibes and stuff that are out there. But she can offer great, great insight. Remember, I'm not going to turn there, remember the story of Abigail and Nabal? I mean, David sent his men in to see if Nabal would give them some rations and stuff. That he was still fleeing from Saul at that time, and of course Nabal blew a gasket over it, and Abigail comes in and says, let me take care of this. He's trying to soothe things over. There's lessons, you know, you can learn on both sides. She can offer great insight. He needs, we as men, we need to do our homework and develop foresight, to be able to see down the road, see how this plays out. In 1 Timothy, we read that the woman was deceived by Satan, but the man, Adam, was not. He wasn't deceived, but he yielded, didn't he? But he yielded, and he shouldn't have. The whole course of history was set right there. But it says in 1 Timothy, the woman was deceived, but Adam was not. A lot of good it did for him to not be deceived when he went against what he knew to be his better judgment. He knew better. Let me turn to Acts 13. I think you'll see. Let me just put it this way. I find it interesting. Acts 13. And there was a lot of animosity and persecution being stirred up against the church. And interesting how it came about here in this incident right here, Acts 13:50. We're breaking into the middle of something. And it says, but the Jews stirred up the devout and prominent women, and the chief men of the city raised up persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them from their region. If you read that, what I think it says, I could be wrong. What did the Jews who wanted to get at Paul, what did they do? They stirred up the devout and prominent women, and then the devout and prominent women stirred up the chief men. That's how it played out. And they yielded to that. So we don't want those things to develop. And again, I speak in broad terms here. I know that, and there are exceptions to all of it, but not exclusively. I don't mean this exclusively at all. But to an extent, I believe, women can tend to stir up a hell of a fuss over something that really doesn't matter. Let's just put it that way. And a man has a responsibility to, you know, listen, because she may very well have a very good point. But we need to listen to one another and not get caught up in this frenzy. But this, you know, Acts 13:50, I think is very telling. And there's other scriptures that would support that as well. Men, Ecclesiastes 10:18 tells us that because of laziness, the rafters sink. Because of laziness, the rafters sink. In other words, we have our part to do. We need to have foresight. We need to be taking care of the things that need to be taken care of. She needs to sense value and acceptance. The wife needs to sense value and acceptance. Again, what we're looking at this from the standpoint, brethren, of that foundry. Because we want to produce those children that God wants, that godly seed. Let's go back to Genesis 29. This goes a long way. It's just, to me, it's food for thought. Let's leave it at that. But women desire deeply this sense of acceptance and to be valued. And you remember the story of Jacob, how he worked for Laban for 7 years, and then Laban, on the eve of the wedding, he sent his oldest daughter, Leah, in to the tent with Jacob. And Jacob was unaware. But Jacob loved Rachel, Leah's sister. That's who he thought he was getting. But Laban deceived him. Leah never had the joy that God intended of knowing she was with a man who deeply cared for her and appreciated her and placed value upon her. She knew what had been done. Laban did a great, great, horrible disservice to that woman. And Rachel, for many years, couldn't bear any children. Leah could bear children. And Leah always thought, after she'd have one child, and the thought was, now Jacob's going to care for me because I've given him yet another son. And it never happened because it wasn't there. Her father was a horrible man in that he did that. But let's go to Genesis 29, verse 34. This is speaking of Leah. Genesis 29, 34. She conceived again and bore a son and said, now, this time, my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. That was her whole great desire, is that her husband would become attached to her. It wasn't ever going to happen. He was attached to Rachel. But that's what women want. And it's God-ordained. It's God-made. She wants that deep sense of appreciation and to be dealt with in a gentle way. Men, by and large, you can go back, Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 22. It begins dealing with the marriage relationship. But I'm just going to go to the last verse, the conclusion, verse 33. Nevertheless, because there's these broad guidelines, which is the best we're trying to get today. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects, or reverences, actually is what it means, to see that she respects her husband. Men crave that. That is what men want. They want respect. They want respect. He must sense respect and appreciation. A sense of self-worth. A man needs that, wants it. And that's just a side point, brethren. But you see how a socialist welfare state works against the way men are made. Because if something's handed to you, if somebody supports you and you don't earn it, what sense of self-respect do you have? It's an ungodly system that does that. It's an ungodly system. Men need a sense of self-respect. And these are things that make that foundry work. These are things that make that foundry work. We must follow the pattern, brethren, set by Paul for us and as recorded in Philippians 3. Let's go to Philippians 3 and we'll try to wrap things up here really quick. Philippians 3, let's follow this pattern that was set by Paul. Philippians 3. And verse 12, where he says, not that I have already attained or am already perfected, but I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ Jesus has also laid hold of me. What does he do? He presses on. He presses forward, just as the boys who took Point Du Hoc. They pressed on. One rope was cut, they grabbed another one. One man fell, another one took his place because the cliff had to be taken because the big guns were up there and they were raining death upon their brothers on the beach. So, brethren, for each of us, don't ask yourself, when it comes to that marriage relationship and for the most part, any part of life, don't ask yourself how you feel. Don't bother with it. Ask yourself, rather this, before God, what is my duty to do? Before God, what it is my duty to do. And there will be a cliff that you're supposed to take. There will be a cliff someplace you're supposed to take. Romans 12, 10 through 11, Paul says, not lagging in diligence, be fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. If we'll bear this in mind, too, one final scripture, then I want to go back to Mr. Eisenhower's words for a moment. When David, at the time of his death, and we think of this in terms perhaps of political leaders who rule over larger numbers of people. But this principle applies in a home. It would apply as a husband, as the head of a home. It would apply as a wife, as the leader in his absence. And it says in 2 Samuel 23, the God of Israel spoke to me, it's recorded, he who rules over men must be just. He who has a family, she who has a family, must be just. But it goes on. The God of Israel spoke to me, he who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. Ruling in the fear of God. And if we do that, as it continues, he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing out of the earth. He will bring good to all of those around him. So let's finish where we began, with Mr. Eisenhower's words before the launch of the D-Day invasion, with just a few adjustments to it. So instead of soldiers, sailors, and airmen, we'd say, brethren, you are about to embark, or have long ago embarked upon it. You are about to embark on a great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you, although the eyes of the world don't know that they're upon you. But Scripture tells us that all of creation groans together for the revealing of the sons of God. The eyes of the world upon you. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. God will accept nothing less than victory.